from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Spoiled milk, gory movies, slimy slugs, monkey brains. Ooh, gross. Disgust is a powerful, visceral reaction and a vital part of what makes us human. The science of disgust is fascinating. It's part instinctive, part cultural. Disgust goes very deep, but can also be changed and manipulated. This hour on Point, ooh, gross, that's disgusting. We're talking about the science of disgust. You can join the conversation. Do you understand why you're disgusted by what disgusts you? Is there something that drives you crazy with disgust, but your best friend doesn't mind at all? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. I'm going to bring in our disgust expert in just a moment, but just for a couple of examples of how we think and talk about it, here it is, Carnegie Hall, 1982. The late comedian George Carlin explains how he copes with the mysteries he finds in his refrigerator.
I guess the worst thing that can happen cleaning out or looking through the refrigerator is to come across something that you cannot identify at all. You literally do not know what it is. Could be meat. Could be cake. Usually at a time like that, I'll bluff. Honey, is this good?
Could be meat, could be cake. That's disgusting. And here's a little bit from an episode of Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs. Host Mike Rowe visits a skull cleaning company in Oklahoma City. Fighting back the stench, he helps prepare animal skeletons for sale.
What is this?
This is a boil here. We boil our larger skulls to remove the tissue.
Do you smell this?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Specifically, what is in there?
There's bison skulls and there's a horse skeleton that we're going to work today.
You have an entire horse skeleton?
Entire horse skeleton's in here. Let's start with this one. Oh, you got to let it drip.
Oh, you just reach in and grab it?
Well, kind of. It's hot.
Nice guitar picking there with horse skeletons and bison skulls, and ooh, there's some tissue. We're talking about disgust today. What's disgusting and why and where the whole sense of disgust is located, where it comes from. Joining me now in the studio is Rachel Herz. She's a psychologist, neuroscientist, leading expert on the sense of smell. Her new book is That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. Rachel Herz, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
So what's disgusting and what's not?
Well, anything can be disgusting and anything pretty much can be not disgusting. It really has to do with your own perspective and what you bring to the table when you experience whatever it is that you're experiencing.
Are there things that by nature, by evolution, by instinct as human beings, we are almost certain to find disgusting?
Not really. I mean, and the reason we know this is because the few cases that there have been of feral wild children, for instance, mm-hmm. that have been raised by wolves and so forth, when they're discovered, they do not show disgust the way anyone else. In fact, they don't show it at all, nor do young children. And it seems as though we have to learn to be disgusted, and we learn through socialization. The primary socialization mechanism is through potty training, generally. So generally across
the
board.
Don't do that here. Do that there.
Exactly. So generally across the board, poop is quote-unquote disgusting, but it varies greatly between cultures because, I mean, for instance, in North America, it's very disgusting. Mm-hmm. But in other places, for instance, certain African villages and so forth, it's fine to squat down with the proverbial newspaper kind of wherever and
do your thing.
Yeah.
And I've been in Tibetan villages on the high plateau where their rooftops are stacked with buffalo chips that are going to be burned all winter long, you know, so they're sort of stacking poop all over the roof and bringing it to the house. They'll cook and eat on it. That's the fuel that's available. But you do write about evolution and how evolution has set us up, has predisposed us to find certain kinds of things to make us very wary of them, to say the least.
Well, absolutely. So disgust isn't, we don't have it by accident. And all of our emotions are there to protect us and keep us alive. And the emotion of disgust is there to prevent us two things primarily, one from ingesting toxins and poisons, and the other to protect us from disease. And the mechanisms that this works by are through our senses and through what we've learned to be the signals that indicate the danger. So George Carlin might have developed a learned cue that furry black mold on the thing he can't identify means that even if it is cake, he shouldn't be eating it. Similarly, there are certain smells that we've learned to indicate that this is the sour milk and the rotted flesh or whatever the case might be, just as we've also learned that a person who looks a certain way, who's pale and maybe has pussy red sores on them and is giving a phlegmy cough is someone that we should stay away from. But that is not instinctive. That is something that we have to learn. These are the signals of sickness, and this is what we must stay away from.
So that means what? Our parents, our families, our communities are our biggest tutors when it comes to deciding what's disgusting.
Absolutely. And you see enormous cross-cultural differences, and food is probably the classic example.
We'll travel around the world a little bit, but let's start close to home. I mean, we've got a very multicultural country, so there would not be perfect unanimity even here. But within an American context, what are the great seats of disgust causation?
Well, certainly the ones that we're all most familiar with, the body fluids and the body products, the rotted food, one of the other interesting things is certain kinds of behavior. So animalistic behavior, people who spit on the ground or who chew with their mouth open or who pick their toes in public. Mm-hmm. These kinds of things we also find disgusting, and this is obviously social code breaking, not necessarily anything else. And it's not necessarily indicating poison or disease, but what this is indicating is another feature of disgust, and that is reminding us that we are actually animals, and we try to pretend that we're not and protect the fact with all kinds of social codes and civilized behavior. But fundamentally, we're just like all the other creepy crawlies. And what this means is that we're going to get squished one day, one way or the other, and we're going to die. And the fundamental fear of death is really the driving force behind the emotion of disgust.
So the royal road to sort of understanding disgust are things that we come to link to death, anything that reminds us that we're mortal.
Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it.
So what are some of the outposts of that fear then? What leads back toward death?
Well, clearly anything that reminds us of our animal nature, and in addition to the picking toes.
So that's what takes us to all the ooh gross about biological things. That's the poo. That's the picking the toes. That's the maybe even the smell of perspiration if it's not one that we like. All those things that say you're an animal, therefore you will one day rot and die yourself.
Exactly. But also because I'm an animal and because as humans we actually consider ourselves to be predatorless, but we in fact have a major predator of extreme importance, and that is pathogens, disease. So anything that looks like we could be possibly in the path of succumbing to something like that is also something you want to stay away from. Again, the fear of death being the underlying mediator. So the person who looks a particular way or who is emitting other signals of sickness. Another aspect which is connected to behavior that we find repulsive is sexual behavior that we consider quote-unquote inappropriate. And that can range from anything from adultery to homosexuality to whatever your predilections
are. Quite personal in how we interpret that. Now, why would that go back to, I don't know, why is that in the same category as pathogens or death relation?
Because everything that has sex dies. It's sort of a primary a primary principle. And it also really brings us back to our animal nature. I mean, the sort of making the beast with two backs metaphor is sort of deeply in there. And we try to pretend that humans we personally don't really have sex. We make love and so forth. And
we magically reproduce. The stork drops off the bundle.
Right. Exactly.
But it's very biological.
It's very biological. It's very sweaty. It's very body fluid sharing. And so it brings us up close with all the possible threats, actually, that could potentially lead to our demise. If we have sex with a very ill person, we could actually die as a consequence. But it also brings us back to the fact that by having sex, it's also a signal that we're animals who will ultimately die.
There is so much to unpack here, and who would have thunk it? When it comes to disgust, we get right down to the basic nature of human life, of all life. I want to get our listeners right in here. Speculator New York, Randy is calling. Randy, thanks. You're on the air with Rachel Herz.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you know?
I'm just calling. In my own house, we have a conflict.
Okay, what is it?
I'm a fur trapper.
Okay.
All right, I'm out in the woods after animals, and of course, I use a variety of different smells and such, one of them being skunk essence, another one being decayed meat. And my 9-year-old beautiful little daughter and I skin muskrats and stuff, and my wife can't even be on the property. My wife is actually a vegetarian.
Oh, no. So. Oh, no, you've got a problem. How does she deal with you, you carnivorous-smelling man?
Yeah, and so, I'm wondering, is there something to override or circumvent her disgust with, myself and my 9-year-old little girl going out and doing these things and deer hunting and things, Adirondack stuff that we do?
Yeah.
That would help at least keep her on the property while we're doing
right, keep the marriage together. Randy, we're up against the clock, but I love your call. Thank you for it. Rachel, what about it? How do we keep peace in this kingdom? A vegetarian and a fur trapper. He's got skunk, goo all over him. She doesn't touch meat. Can they bridge it?
Well, she has to be motivated to want to make this work. And if she is, then the thing that she needs to do is actually get down and dirty. She needs to be able to expose herself to it, because the more you expose yourself to the trigger of your aversion, actually the less aversive it becomes. We sort of become inured to these things that initially were, horrifying to us. We just, for example, people who medical workers initially, mm-hmm. they have a really hard time coming to accident mm-hmm. scenes. And then, it's just a daily job. And
but isn't that a lot to ask of a vegetarian? Get down in my, skunk goo and carcass parts?
Well, it is a lot to ask of a vegetarian, because I'm guessing most likely your wife became a vegetarian for moral reasons as opposed to health reasons. And people who become vegetarians for moral reasons are actually much more entrenched in considering meat disgusting, and also, unfortunately, meat eaters. So Randy and his daughter are also less positive in her mind, maybe not because of her immediate family, but generally speaking.
Randy, good luck to you. It sounds like a tall order, but maybe you'll do it. Did some trapping myself as a young man. It's amazing, what you get used to in that world. But if you're a vegetarian, that's going to look disgusting. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the psychology and science of disgust. What disgusts us and why? What disgust tells us about ourselves, our culture, our evolutionary inheritance. My guest is Rachel Herz. Her book is That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. She's written a lot about the sense of smell. The Scent of Desire was her first book. She does a lot of consulting to big companies thinking about smell. Smell and disgust can easily converge. We like to keep those two apart if we possibly can. Rachel, let's get right into some of this. Jen writes us on a line, and she asks a question. She says, why am I not repulsed by my own child's vomit, snot, feces, etc., but have to gag, grin, and bear it when caring for other children, not my own?
Well, that's a great question, and that's because one of the core aspects of disgust is about the self and keeping the self protected from the outside, from the strange.
Mm-hmm.
And our babies, and actually it turns out also our pets, we consider them part of ourselves, mm-hmm. and anything part of ourself is much better than something from the outside world. So your baby's poop, and it's also been shown that even your dog's breath or your dog's poop is considered pretty fine, and also the things that come out of your own body. I mean, some people admire it. But if it were a stranger's, or even somebody who you knew but just not connected to you, it would be quite repulsive.
So it's the us and the other.
Absolutely. So the idea of keeping the outside away from our inside is really exemplified also in the disgust face. So what happens when we make the face of disgust is
we all know that kind of ooh face.
Right. Like your eyes scrunch down, mm-hmm. you're sort of closing them, your nose pierces shut a little bit, your mouth, grimaces down. Sometimes we stick our tongue out if we're trying to expel something, but generally the face is shutting down and the face is closing off itself from the outside to
mm-hmm.
stop whatever it is from getting
closing
in.
Closing the eyes, closing the mouth, and trying to suck in the nostrils almost.
Yeah, absolutely. So that we are not letting in whatever effluvia or other nasty things that we might be exposed to, including even things that we see, because our eyes are actually taking in less light when we are in the disgust phase.
And, of course, our eyes, as you write, they sort of read things in such fine-grained detail. If it's disgusting, we don't want to see it. On the other hand, we go to horror films. We'll talk about that. You've got so many facets to this question. This keeping the other out is really interesting when it comes to your great theme here also of how disgust can be manipulated. If you can label something or someone as the other, then they're automatically sort of more prone to that disgust response from your audience. Politicians know this.
Absolutely. It's in fact, one of the more unfortunate aspects of disgust is how it's been manipulated politically and sociologically to incite hatred towards other groups of people.
Or even genocide. I was in Rwanda where, of course, on the radio, they famously called the other out as cockroaches. And the next thing you know, you had Hutus taking down Tutsi with the machetes in the most terrible fashion.
Well, exactly. The Rwanda example is perfect. So is Nazi Germany, where Jews were vilified as rats. So basically, you're taking a human being and you're transforming them into an object of disgust that's subhuman, vermin.
There's a lot of that in the propaganda of that terrible time.
Absolutely. So you're now making this whole group of people non-human, and not only non-human. It's not like they're garbage cans. They're literally vermin and other sorts of things which we are repulsed by. And we also would like to get rid of. So we don't have any problem eliminating, quote-unquote, the enemy in this case, because it is perceived more easily as being vermin that we want to eradicate.
It can go all the way up to very grand themes of political manipulation, even genocide if you're not careful. It's also just as common and everyday as our interaction with what's at the back of the fridge, as George Carlin had it there. Rachel Herr's book is That's Disgusting. Let's go to our callers. Lauren, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about a phobia. I know a few women who have, including me. It's a fear of holes and clusters of holes and also clusters of bumps, and especially bumps with holes, so like barnacles and lotus pods. It seems to kind of run in families, and it's not really a fear so much as just like a horrifying disgust.
Bumps and holes. So you would hate a sort of a bumpy Swiss cheese or barnacles, you say, or I'm trying to think what else would present
mostly
bumps and holes in it.
I haven't seen much. So if I've seen a thing a lot, like a sponge doesn't really scare me because I've seen it a ton, but something new with holes absolutely is scary to me. But barnacles are my earliest memory of it, so I've never really gotten over that one.
Women who hate bumps and holes and barnacles. Rachel, what do you say?
Well, Lauren, that's really fascinating. And actually, since I've been doing radio shows from the book, you're not the first person to say this. But what it's connected to two things, I think. One is the aspect that there's a deformation. You know, something which we normally see as smooth or round has holes in it and is bumpy. So this deformation also reminds us of our animalness, our sort of ability to become mutilated, our ability to be harmed and maimed. And so things that are of unusual shapes and have these strange perforations, I think, elicit part of that reaction. And you also said something very interesting, and basically because you were calling it fear. And I believe that disgust actually evolved from the emotion of fear. It's a version of fear that only humans possess because it has this different dimension that we really have to think in order to understand why we're repelled, why we're horrified by whatever it is. And this reaction of fear and disgust commingle a lot in a lot of phobias.
So fear, disgust, and maybe deformity as the underlying concern when you look at those kind of textures.
Exactly. I think so. And they also, I think, have possible reminiscences to creatures which are possible vectors of disease, you know, the slimy, creepy crawlies that we are generally aversive to. And part of that could be their disease connection, also because they have some connection to certain body products that we find repulsive.
Lauren, good luck with that. Lee in Dixon, Tennessee. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I hate Parmesan cheese. I find it terribly disgusting. To me, even opening the jar smells like vomit. And I don't understand how people can eat this stuff.
Where does that leave you, Lee? I mean, you know, you can't go to an Italian restaurant or even to the cupboard if they're going to shake on the Parmesan?
Well, I do sit at the table with my husband when he eats it, but I just don't understand how he can love such a thing.
Well, actually, Lee, that's a great point. I even once did an experiment where I took the chemicals that comprise Parmesan cheese and also the characteristics of vomit, which happened to be the same, so you're absolutely right. And what I found out was how I labeled it. So if I called it Parmesan cheese, people really liked it, but if I called it vomit, they were disgusted by it. And then the fact it wouldn't even believe it was the same thing. And part of it, I think, in your case, you're very anchored in the one version of it in terms of interpretation. Your meaning of Parmesan cheese is is vomit. So whenever you smell that, you immediately go to the vomit side. You don't go to the yummy cheese side. Now, if you were more of a cheese lover, then potentially, or if your experiences early on with this odor had possibly been different, you may be either more switchable, or you might just think, oh, this is great. This is Parmesan cheese. I love it. Unfortunately, when we form associations to smells, they're very hard to undo. So your connection of Parmesan cheese smelling like vomit is going to be difficult to get away from, I think.
Lee, good luck with that. Rachel, give us some other examples of when we walk that line. It's so interesting because you could be in a supermarket, smell a Parmesan cheese that would make you think somebody had just upchucked in the aisle, or smell it and think, oh, I got to have some of that. And it could be the same person, you know, uncertain, just right there on the line between disgust and even attraction.
Absolutely. So basically what, Tom, you just got at is the fact that it is the meaning that we apply to whatever the trigger is that determines whether we think it's disgusting or delightful. And the meaning that we apply is determined by the situation that we're in, the context, the language that's being used to describe it, our personality, or even our mood at the time. And so our approach to whatever that trigger is going to be, you know, possibly hanging on a thread between being disgust and delightful, depending on how we feel at that moment.
Let's stick with cheese for a minute, because that's a big cultural divider. But more or less half the world, or at least the sort of Buddhist part that didn't eat dairy products, China and that realm, can find cheese really, really gross. On the other hand, in Western society, we like it as just as goopy and sometimes stinky as it can be. The more the better.
Absolutely. And this is also brings up, I think, every culture has their favorite fermented rot. And cheese happens to be controlled rot. It is, in fact, what the Asians call it, which is putrefied cow excrement. Or excretions.
I guess that's one
anyway.
Way of calling milk.
Or excretions in any case. Mm-hmm. And because that's what it is. It is putrefied milk, but it is done in a controlled way. And we have been exposed to it only in the context of it being completely positive, anything from a comfort food to a delicacy.
Mm-hmm. Whereas we'll have top chefs sort of pouring it around and talking about how pungent it smells and luxuriating in it. You might see half of, Chongqing or some Chinese city running away.
Absolutely. But they have their own things that they find delicious that we find.
Fermented eggs, let's say.
100-year-old eggs. Also, the Japanese eat something for breakfast called natto, which is fermented soybeans, mm-hmm. really sticky, slimy stuff. And I don't know anyone who's a Western from born and bred perspective that can bring it anywhere near their mouth. It just has to do with what we construe the meaning of food to be. And it's totally culturally dependent.
So there's a lot that really depends on where you were brought up, what you're accustomed to, what you were told is delicious, what you were told is disgusting. Byron in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Byron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. I just wondered if your author had done any work looking at certain monastic traditions, like in Buddhism in Sri Lanka. There's a tradition where monks actually meditate on a decomposing corpse. And it's this whole process of overcoming aversion through exposure to it, but also then having compassion for the death that every living being experiences. And I used to feel really creeped out by dead animals on the road, and then I started doing meditation myself. So it's just an interesting idea about how do we overcome this kind of inherent disgust.
Have you meditated on a corpse, Byron?
No, not me.
But there's
a tradition of mm-hmm. monks in Sri Lanka who do that.
Wow, that's a discipline, and one that goes not only to the sense of disgust, but maybe, Rachel, to your description of the underlying issue here, which is meditating on death itself.
Well, absolutely. That's a great I like that story, Byron. I did not know about the monks in Sri Lanka. I do, however, think that, I mean, the technique they're using, in fact, is used by Western practitioners in psychotherapy, getting people over disgust-based phobias and other kinds of phobias, is, in fact, to expose yourself to it and thereby become accepting of it. And the idea, though, that's underlying this, that not only are you being exposed to something that's dead, but something that's putrefying and giving, you know, the process of decay, and the Buddhist culture concept of the connection of everything, the cycle of life, the living, the dead, and the whole continuum. I think that's really nice, but I haven't done any work on it personally.
That may be more of a challenge than a lot of people would take on, but interesting, fascinating to hear about that story. One more in this vein, maybe Robin in Westboro, Massachusetts. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk about, I guess, the subjectivity of what is disgusting. I'm a veterinary student, and we actually just had a cow lab. So right now I'm covered in cow poop from about the waist down.
Okay.
Have it in my hair, got some in my eye.
Woohoo!
But I'm more worried about my ophthalmology lecture this afternoon because eyeballs gross me out beyond belief. So I just kind of wanted to say, you know, comment on that about how one thing can be disgusting to one person and I, you know, don't blink. Whereas eyeballs are fine for a lot of people and they just give me the heebie-jeebies.
Can you describe for us what it is? I mean, you're fine with the manure, Robin, we got that. But eyeballs, what about them grosses you out, disgusts you?
I don't know. They're just gooey and they're just icky. Like, I don't like fish because they don't blink. It's weird. I know. But eyeballs, I don't like them.
It's subjective. On the other hand, here we go again, Rachel. Eyeballs can poets can go on for pages about the beauty of eyes.
Right. But, I mean, actually, eyeballs are something that most people do have a very hard time with. And it's because of a couple reasons. One, it's because they are, in fact, coverings of the holes on our body. And Paul Rozin wrote a really interesting paper a while ago about how we're very protective of our holes, our mouth, our ears, our genitals, obviously. And these are places where the outside, again, could invade our inside. And even though our eyes are sort of the covering for those holes, they're still holes. And the fact also, as you mentioned, they're gelatinous, they're gooey. Again, these sort of visceral triggers of disgust are embedded in there. Plus, they can be maimed so easily. They can be mutilated so easily that they're very, and we realize how fragile they are. They're, again, that reminder of how squishable we are. So there's a lot of reasons that go into finding eyeballs disgusting, and Robin's not alone.
Robin, maybe here's a little advice from the Roman statesman Cicero, who Rachel Herz quotes, it might help you find the beauty. The greatest pleasures, he wrote, are only narrowly separated from disgust. Maybe look to the beauty of that eyeball. You write, Rachel, compellingly about this close linkage, sort of close cousinship between disgust and, kind of surprisingly, but then not maybe, lust. Disgust and lust. What's the linkage?
Well, there's a neurological linkage in the sense that there are brain areas that respond equivalently, not all parts of the brain, but certain parts of the brain that respond equivalently to lustful situations and disgusting situations.
Help us, what's an example, if you can help us get closer to that?
I mean, an example from the point of view of where in the brain?
What, disgust and lust are close together?
Well, they're close together in the sense of, again, this is neural activation. So where, for instance, there was an experiment done where people who were either S&M prone or non-S&M prone were shown photographs of people engaged in S&M, as well as also regular sex and disgusting visual things that sort of more visceral level. And it turned out that obviously the people who were S&M prone thought that the S&M pictures were disgusting. S&M, they thought it was erotic.
Appealing, yeah.
Yes, whereas the non-S&M people thought it was disgusting.
Okay.
But where in the brain that their areas were activated were in fact very similar. So even though one group is saying this is disgusting and the other is saying it's turning me on, their brains were looking very similar. Now, disgust, if we're disgusted by someone directly, it's probably the biggest barrier to wanting to become intimate with them. So that's they clash there. So and in fact, smell also plays a very big role here. So if you find the smell of someone repulsive, then you are not going to be able to climb into bed with them. But if you are not in that sort of necessarily repulsed by a particular person zone, what we consider disgusting or lustful, really there are a lot of commonalities. Think about body fluids. So in one case, for example, if a stranger licked your face, that could be disgusting. But if your lover did that, it would be erotic.
Ooh la la.
And I mean, all the sharing of body fluids that goes on also in lovemaking, that's an example of where normally that could be disgusting. But in the case of being with your lover, it's delightful. So again,
in a way, a switch flips in there somewhere. It's slippery, slimy, gross. It's slippery.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a very fine line between the things that we find erotic and repulsive. And even, for instance, the aphrodisiac foods like oyster, for instance. If you want to think of it in its sort of most slimy context, it's hardly appealing. Yet it
is first time out, most people are like, oh, what? But then?
Right, but it's the most acclaimed aphrodisiac ever described.
Is that because it's chemically aphrodisiac, or are you saying that the sort of disgusting texture of it from a, you know, a newbie's point of view. Once you get over that hump, you're closer to lust land.
Well, there's no real good science that says it's going to increase libido or performance capacity or anything like that. But there is evidence that, for instance, its resemblance to the female genitalia, also that it's kind of, you know, you have to be brave to eat it. These are sort of aspects of virility that show you're powerful, you're attractive, and so on. So it's, again, it's all in the mind.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the psychology and science of disgust. What disgusts us and why? What disgust tells us about ourselves, our culture, our evolutionary inheritance. Smellologist, psychologist, neuroscientist Rachel Herz is with us. A really interesting new book is That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. I should say you can find a link at our website to a survey from Rachel's book that measures your sensitivity to disgust. I've taken it. I came out about average, I guess, but who knows? There's many paths to average. We may each have our own. Rachel responds online here. April says, lots of people find Chinese stinky tofu intolerantly disgusting due to its smell, but boy, does it taste good. Yum. So there you go. That maybe April may have both of those reactions to it, you know, at the same time. Morgan says that she rarely, or it rarely revolts others, but Marmite on my toast, that staple kind of UK spread, revolts in the US with an intensity that shocks me, not precisely clear precisely why. And Jessica says, my first day working in a commercial pig farm, I was totally repulsed, but I worked through my disgust and can now castrate, farrow, vaccinate, teeth clip, tail dock, ear notch, and euthanize with the best of them. Having grown up on a farm, you know, where we would castrate hundreds of pigs every late winter, early spring, well, it's amazing what you can get used to flying around. Eric in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air with Rachel Herz.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the ancient Roman condiment called garum, which was a bunch of fish would be put, entrails and all, would be put into a container. Maybe a little salt was added and left out in the sun to basically rot. And it was a favorite condiment of ancient Romans. And you can imagine the street smell and the disgust today of smelling these street smells in garum.
Hey, may I ask you, Eric, I'll take it to Rachel, but having spent a lot of time in Asia, you can find fermenting fish very, very widely to make fish paste. Have you smelled that? Is it the same or different from garum? Do you know?
I don't know. I think the large difference in being a chef is that you don't want to get entrails in any part of the food that you want.
Mm-hmm.
But here in this ancient way of doing it, they would let the whole fish kind of ferment and they would use the liquid, and that was the prized portion of it. So the steaming vat and the sun and things rising to the surface, and it was a really prized condiment. There was a ship that went down, and it was worth millions. It was a really prized...
Amazing. Of rotting fish guts. Hey, I promise I'll take that too, but you're a chef. Let me ask you while I've got you, Eric. Do you find that there are some condiments today that, you know, on their own are borderline disgusting, but when you include them in some special dish, maybe exactly the little undefinable flavor that makes it taste amazingly good?
I think a lot of people are surprised that Worcestershire sauce has fish in it. I think anchovies maybe, that might be the one. But I love all the aspects. I'm not usually disgusted in that way, but I think it's pretty cool in spices and changing things when you add heat and a combination of them.
Yeah, Rachel, what about it here? Garum, the ancient Roman condiment, doesn't sound that different to me from something you describe in the book, an Icelandic way of preparing shark.
Right, harkarl is the Icelandic delicacy, and it is rotted shark meat, and it is left to decompose outside for upwards of several months, and then it is hung out to dry, and it is eaten. And actually, its smell, which is highly ammonia-like, so it smells a lot like urine, is apparently one of the worst aspects of it. But the reason that this was invented, so to speak, is because, in fact, eating the flesh of the shark fresh is poisonous because there's a lot of uremic acid in the shark meat. So this was, in fact, very dangerous to do. And they discovered that by letting it rot and putrefy, the uremic acid basically seeps out and then it becomes edible. So this was sort of a case of necessity.
They bury the whole shark, guts included, I think.
Yeah.
And for months and months, and then just pull it out and yum, yum.
Right. But it's also interesting that Eric spoke about the idea of entrails being something you definitely want to keep away from food. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously because the digestive tract, having the decomposed food that the animal has eaten, you don't want to be eating that too, because it's basically eating excrement. But it's also the case that depending upon what the animal is, that could be completely harmless to us. And it's, again, how we construe the meaning of what, you know, the fact that we're basically eating rotted excrement, you know, with lots of other stuff. You know, is this really disgusting? Is it, in fact, harmful? Well, if it's not harmful and the culture approves of it or lauds it even, then it can be quite fantastic.
We can be very expansive in our definitions if it's ultimately not harmful. Janine says, please tell me why mouth noises drive me crazy.
I think that's, again, going back to the animalistic behavior. So, you know, making noises with your body is something that is not socially approved of. It's not part of the codes of polite society. And when someone breaks those codes, we are reminded again of our beastly natures, and we are not happy about that fact. And we don't like people who remind us of that, and we are repulsed by them.
But you tell a story, I forget if it was Bolivia or Ecuador, of women sitting around chewing corn, and spitting into a jar, burying it, making a kind of saliva mash beer of saliva that is then a delicacy. What's that?
So that's called chicha. And that is actually, it is kind of like this strange fermented saliva corn beer, where what happens is exactly what you just said, Tom. That you chew this corn mash and you spit it into a jug. And then after a certain amount of corn mash has been chewed and spit out, this jug is buried in the ground for about a month.
Oh,
and there it's left to ferment. And then it's uncorked and it's this great,
so it's
wonderful
like
thing.
It's like saliva alcohol.
Exactly. Yeah, saliva corn alcohol.
Woo-hoo.
It's like the Jim Beam of Ecuador. So the concept, though, again, is that if you saw someone consume this and then run to the field and retch, then this would obviously become something that would be not good to eat and would be repulsed and would be something that you would reject and stay away from. But if everyone's having a good time, this is the thing to do, nobody's getting sick, then you have to realize then that this is something that's safe, that it's okay. And regardless of what it ultimately comes from, this is now a positive thing.
Can everybody get over anything if we really set our mind to it? I mean, here we have a listener online who writes, is there a way to get over your disgust? We talked about this a little, but I wonder how high the barrier is. This listener says, I want to go to medical school, but I fear that I may not get over the disgust that nearly all medical students experience, from the smell of a preserved corpse to the slicing of bodies to the smells that are released once a body is open. Can anybody, if they put their mind to it, get over anything? Or sometimes is it just a wall, a barrier?
Well, I think, again, here we're going to personality and one's own personal experiences and how deeply ingrained some of those things might be. And so not everybody, I'm going to say, is able to overcome their disgust. But I do think that if one were highly motivated, that by overexposure and constant exposure, everybody gets less disgusted by their initial triggers. Just as this caller said, that the other medical students are also not happy about having to go through the cadaver dissection course for all kinds of reasons. But at the end, it's in fact been shown that after the cadaver dissection course, medical students are a lot less repelled by all sorts of things that they were initially. So this is again showing that exposure is the treatment for overcoming disgust, as well as just changing your mindset. You know, as you said with the eyes, you know, thinking of it as something beautiful. Here you're this is about learning, this is about your profession, this is about caring for and helping people. So, you know, you can just turn it into something else and it would make it a lot easier.
And just remember, you know, all the things that are done with pleasure around the world. I remember an evening in a night market in Taiwan watching elderly Chinese gentlemen who would sit, they tied snakes by ribbons up above them. They'd sit on a little stool. The shopkeeper would snip off the end of the tail. They would suck the blood out of this live snake. Ooh, couldn't be better. Deborah in West Hartford, Connecticut. Deborah, you're on the air.
I'm enjoying the snake story. Let me get over that one first.
Okay.
But buttons. I mean, they're pretty simple, everyday items. But all my life I've been disgusted by buttons, particularly when they're loose, lying around with a thread or without a thread, or even in a jar or used with craft.
Okay, Deborah, I got to say, that sounds kinky. What about them? What about buttons? Why?
That's what I'm asking you.
You don't. But is it you don't like the way they click together, or you don't like the way that they're round and shiny, or...
Nope, it's a disgust. They seem dirty. They seem whatever. Of course, you talk about getting used to things by using them. You have buttons everywhere, but I prefer clothes without them, but I will wear clothes with them. But if a button falls off, I'm not the one who's going to sew it back on unless I really, really have to.
And I guess you're not going for a military man. What about it, Rachel?
Well, I think that's very interesting. All kinds of people have very individualistic disgust triggers. But I think that maybe there's a connection between buttons and beetles, little insects that scurry around that look like, all buttons are black.
Maybe,
but yeah, the shiny shell concept. And we're also disgusted by the concept of the swarm. You know, a swarm of ants, a swarm of whatever kind of insect it is much more threatening because, again, the swarm can get in and envelop us. Mm-hmm. Whereas one or two of whatever they are is a lot less threatening. So like Deborah said, you know, maybe one button's not so bad, but a whole bunch of buttons in a jar, it's reminiscent of the sort of teeming with life, the wildness of life. And again, this is harkens back to our fear of our animal nature and the underlying death
and
that's there.
Being overwhelmed maybe or swarmed. Maybe something right there on buttons. Kevin in Boston. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your guest mentioned that she thought there was a universal facial expression.
Mm-hmm. You!
Kind of squinching the face, tightening the eyes, maybe blowing out the breath. And in this culture, anyway, among young girls, they often have a vocal expression to accompany that, which is E-E-E-W-W-W.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if that is also universal, that vocal expression.
Well, I just said it. I haven't been a young girl for a while, but maybe, I don't know, are there different vocalizations of disgust that you've seen, Rachel?
That's a great question. I actually do not know the answer to that. I don't know if there's just that stereotypical ew reaction. But Kevin does bring up the fact that this is expelling air from the mouth. So the sound that we make when we do that, the exhalation, it is more likely to be an ooh sound because that's what the shape of the mouth would look like than another kind of noise. So my guess is that the vocalizations cross-culturally would be very similar.
Let's go to George in Buffalo, New York. George, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Rachel, since we're all on a first-name basis here.
Mm-hmm.
To move it, to sublimate it away from the immediately gustatory aspect of the not me that is repudiated in service to life itself. What about the idea of disgust at action? Is there a moral sense that a moral self that may need to be preserved in witnessing what is considered something that is unacceptable in that level? That there is not just the death of the body, but the death of some identity that transcends the body involved in disgusting response to disgusting action.
Or a death of goodness. I'm so glad you raised that, George. What about it? We all understand moral disgust. Does it relate to the gustatory physical that George described?
Well, actually, George brought up a fantastic point, and I do write about this quite a bit in my book, that essentially we are protecting the soul just as much as we are protecting the body with the emotion of disgust. So the things that disgust us from a moral perspective are about keeping this sort of defamation or this contamination of other people's ill views or
even our own that we may want to hold at bay, right?
That's possible too. But our response is definitely, again, the underlying feature is about rejecting. It's about keeping away, keeping out these bad thoughts, these bad morals, these bad juices from other people.
Don't pollute my soul with evil or whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely. And it's fairly controversial the extent to which moral disgust is the same as gagging when you've eaten rotten meat, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more on the side of the fact that it's more really about the emotion of anger, although it depends on what level of disgust we're talking about.
Anger at seeing something wrong or bad transpiring?
Right. So the reaction is really more outrage than it is visceral repulsion. However, there are cases where, for instance, the transgression involves a visceral component. So if the moral act is, for instance, something which mutilates a body or desecrates a body, those kinds of things. So there we're bringing in the body, so we're bringing in a visceral quality. But if we're just talking about stealing or lying or being conniving, I believe that the emotion underlying it is truly outrage, which is anger. However, I think it's also very interesting. It seems to be the case that when we use the word disgust, just the word itself can bring out our normal conditioned response to disgust, which is in fact the visceral version, and we then feel physical revulsion just by using the word, and then it becomes tainted by the physical. Whereas if we just said, oh, I'm outraged by this, we would stay within a different realm.
But say, that is disgusting and pretty, and you have cast a big aspersion on something that's likely to infect folks around you as well. Let me go to John in London, Kentucky. John, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. In the Army, in combat arms, the cadence is used to protect us mentally and spiritually for the disgust of the act of killing or being killed.
You're saying cadence, John? Like, hey, hup, hup, hup. The cadence? That kind of?
Well, the cadence is very verbal, and very briefly, one of them is, I don't know, but I hear tell, airborne rangers come from hell.
Yeah, that kind of marching cadence. That kind of marching cadence, and you say that it helps you overcome disgust at the sort of fighting and killing that you may then do as a soldier?
The verbiage that they teach us is designed to prepare us for that disgust, or to lessen the blow, or to keep you fighting when you wouldn't otherwise because you're desensitized. Your guest spoke to that, and it really helped me.
John, I appreciate your call. Our time is so short, but here's John's a former soldier who knows of what he speaks here. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's really interesting. I had not heard of this as a methodology used in the military, but I think it's also probably a form of distraction. So if you're singing, especially, you know, this kind of cadence with a certain strong beat, mm-hmm. you can be distracted from what you're doing, from what you're seeing, from what you're exposed to more easily because it's both rote and it's got this strong beat to it. And I think that the beat is also empowering, so mm-hmm. you might feel that you can overcome.
Right. You say the emotion of disgust is universal, but you also very interestingly say that in the end, very often, disgust is a luxury. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that actually is that in order to be able to be disgusted, we have to have choices. We have to say, well, I mean, there's this rotted meat here, but I could have this good piece of meat.
So I'm free to say, oh, gross, forget it.
Exactly. Or here's this ugly, deformed person that is the only one around as a possible mate. Well, there's no other choices. I'm going to have to then overcome disgust. Mm-hmm. I can't be disgusted because if the propagation of the species is what is mm-hmm. at hand, then mm-hmm. this is the person I'm going to be involved with. So in order to have disgust, we have to have the luxury and the privilege of the choice for survival. But if we don't have any choices, if it's just this or nothing, like these survival shows, you know, people go out mm-hmm. into the wilderness and they have to eat the live grubs and do whatever, then disgust just goes away because we don't have a choice about it.
It's a luxury when we're up against it. When that's all there is, it may look just fine.
It's a luxury of abundance, I think, we have the privilege for.
Rachel Herz, we're so grateful to you for diving into this. It's a really interesting terrain. The book is terrific. There's a quiz at our website you can take. Rachel's put it together to see just how disgustable you are on a scale. Look at onpointradio.org. Rachel Herz's new book is That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. Rachel, thanks so much for coming in. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It was wonderful to be here.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at that website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.